We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, but a special thing that we do at the year's end or near the year's end.
Yeah. Every year. Frightening. It's getting to be that time.
I guess. So the overhyped and underreported stories of the year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there were many of them.
And we're going to split it out over several mornings. So we're going to start this morning with local overhyped and underreported. And I think you typically have more overhyped stories for the year than I do, Job. But I've got three this year for the local. My first on the overhyped list is the Third Arena in Soto.
That was my first one, too. How about that?
Yeah, the idea
How about those Kings? Go Kings!
Yeah. The idea that it would be that easy for us to get an NBA team back here in Seattle was overhyped from the start.
Yeah, and an NHL team, because after the Kings went away, at least a couple of the times, because there's been like four or five iterations of this, they were talking about the Phoenix NHL team for a while too. And we've been talking from the start when this first came up a couple of years ago that a financial model based on luring an NBA and an NHL team or even one of the two, is pretty delusional because those franchise shifts don't happen very often at all. Certainly it's unprecedented for, both leagues to have franchises move to the same city at the same time. And in both leagues, there are several other cities with brand new arenas that are also competing to lure NBA teams. And depending on what team is up for sale or might move, different cities make sense for different franchises. So it's not going to be simple. It's going to take a very long time. And, you know, we could be like Kansas City or a couple of the Anaheim, a couple of these other cities that have built these brand new state-of-the-art arenas that are just sitting there unoccupied because there are no pro teams moving to take advantage of those facilities. That could happen here too, but nobody in Seattle media is willing to talk about that possibility.
Yeah. And then second on my overhyped list was the so-called downtown crime spree, which actually turned out to be just a little kerfluffle between the Downtown Business Association and City Attorney Pete Holmes over how to enforce civility laws. That, I think, was hugely overhyped and was pushed a lot in the mainstream media as, oh, there's a crime spree downtown. Oh, no, it's so dangerous. It's so terrible. Really, it's just a lot of people who are a lot of homeless people, a lot of homeless teenagers, a lot of folks who are not homeless who don't have any place to go or would just like to hang out.
Yeah, crime has actually been trending down in the downtown region over the last several years. The other factor that was involved in that was an attempt to undermine Mike McGinn's reelection campaign. It was very specifically, I think, pointed toward that, and that was the reason why it came up just before the primary and then through the general elections.
And I think an element of that wasn't reported was the fact that the police department, as Job said, was hot on getting McGinn out of office, and so I think they went on a work to rule strike of not patrolling as much downtown as they could have in order to keep people from engaging in fist fights, drunken scuffles, and so forth.
Yeah, and we'll get back to SPD when we talk about the underreported.
I'd just like to point out that was street crime. Corporate crime is still doing pretty well.
And downtown, as a matter of fact, too. How about that? Speaking of kerfuffles, by the way, one of my favorites of the year was the demonstrations on May Day. Excuse me, the riots on May Day. Which, you know, for several days ahead of time, there was all this hand-wringing in TV news and our local daily quote-unquote newspaper about whether the anarchists were going to burn downtown down again this year, like they did in 2012, in case you missed it. Of course, not much happened except, of course, for police violence. There was quite a bit of that. But that it wasn't really framed that way. Meanwhile, there were several thousand immigrants marching for immigrants' rights on the same day that got zero attention whatsoever. But a handful of anarchists being corralled by about three times the number of police as there were protesters got plenty of attention.
Yeah, that apparently qualifies as a riot in somebody's book. I'm not sure whose book or why, but it was hyped that way. And then last on my list of overhyped was ex-Mayor McGinn's gun-free business program. That one was, I think hype from the start. That, as well as his program for reforming the police department, which appeared to be all a marketing ploy.
Yeah, and I could put into that too. I mean, there were several things that McGinn tried to do during the course of the year to sort of enhance his reelection chances. Another one, I think, was the gesture around Whole Foods and the unionization attempt of the workers there. That itself is a legitimate story, but it's a legitimate story that's been going on for several years. Mm-hmm. And McGinn
denying a permit
denying a permit, which will probably be reversed now. You know, was really much ado about not very much, and was instrumental in his getting UFCW's endorsement for the election campaign. That part was actually somewhat significant, but the actual impact on that organizing struggle, not very much.
All right. So those are the overhyped.
Oh, yes, and TV weather news and sports and, you know, all the usual nonsense of commercial media.
All right. And then do we have an underreported for
Yes,
local?
We do.
Oh, we got lots of those.
Number one on my list, and I made a list and narrowed it down to 10, and it turned out about three or four on my list fell under one category, so I put it at number one. It's transportation.
Yeah,
We could spend a whole show talking about the underreported transportation issues in the city and the county and the state, but we're not going to do that. I'm just going to mention a few things that made my list that should get a lot more attention. Number one of those is the $1.8 billion backlog of road maintenance projects in the city of Seattle. The fact that there are 10 bridges in the city alone that are considered structurally deficient. One, the Magnolia Bridge, gets a score of 18 of 100 in terms of sufficiency. That's unsafe. There shouldn't be anybody driving that bridge anymore, but it gets no news coverage.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, a wealthy neighborhood like that can't even get that repair to happen tells you how much the fix is in for where the money has been going instead, which is another underreported story, which is the enormous amount of discretionary money in the transportation budget all going to the streetcar projects, which really don't do a whole lot for anything except real estate development, which is going to be a theme of these stories.
Yeah. State engineers screwing up the 520 bridge pontoons by designing them on the cheap. We've now got about $200 million and counting going into fixing those pontoons. That's another transportation story that got some media play but didn't really get discussed a whole lot. About in terms of, we always go for the cheapest contractors. We always go for designing things on the cheap because you can't spend public money on transportation. Well, what is public money for if it's not for fixing the transportation infrastructure and doing it in a way that isn't going to run up huge cost overruns? Another one on my transportation list was the U.S. Department of Transportation doing a study on tolls on the 520 bridge. Think about it. Tolling the 520 bridge is the first big tolling project here in our part of the state. 520 tolls, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, have cut commutes across 520 bridge in half. And 9 out of 10 of the drivers who no longer drive the 520 bridge do it because tolls are just too expensive for them. In other words, it's a social engineering project where you're taking a tax that is even more regressive, I would argue, than the state sales tax, and you're using it to drive poor people off the road, literally.
Well, or drive them to another road. They're mostly going to I-90.
They're mostly going to I-90, and anybody who's been traveling across I-90 during commuter hours knows that it's just not workable. It's becoming extremely crowded.
Yeah, and then we have, you know, all the cutbacks in public transit that are going on at a time of record ridership, and part of the reason for the record ridership is that it's the people who can't afford things like the 520 tolls that are being pushed into public transit.
Yeah, exactly. That's another issue. Metro Transit is looking at cuts at a time when they need about an equal amount to expand. They need an equal amount of increase to their revenue as they're considering in cuts right now in order just to meet the current demand for bus service, because a lot of people are getting left at their stops because there's no room for them to get on the bus anymore. That's not even addressing potential growth in the next couple of years. So that's another big one. And finally, on my list of transportation issues, Boeing getting $9 billion in tax cuts from the state government. And that's the $9 billion that we really needed for a transportation package that never passed.
Actually, I had that in my Olympia cluster, but I had a couple more transportation also.
Yeah.
One was the emergence of transportation-oriented development as the new buzz phrase for the new urbanists who were doing, you know, corporate welfare under the under the guise of density and development. And again, it's being tied to transportation, so that we're supposed to have these urban clusters now around public transit, except that the public transit for those clusters doesn't really exist. Yeah. It's just a real estate thing. And again, the corporate welfare embedded in this, the rezone of South Lake Union and the streetcar funding, very much about property values and making people rich. And as we've seen with the traffic getting worse with the Mercer mess as well, and with the streetcars, it's not at all about moving more people or goods from one place
it's
to another.
It's about providing nice infrastructure for the wealthy and no infrastructure for the rest of us.
Hence, no sidewalks and potholes in big chunks of the city. No sidewalks, lots of potholes.
Lots of potholes, yeah, and no buses.
So let's move on to Olympia, since you mentioned the abject corruption of Boeing's package and the bipartisan support for it. In 72 hours, I might add, with no public process, I might add, the largest corporate welfare package in the history of any state legislature in the country, and that includes much larger states like New York and California. So that was one. The regulations, or lack thereof, or the overlapping ones surrounding pot legalization. It's been a year now since voters passed, decriminalization of marijuana in Washington state, and at the state and county and local level, city level, both the production and distribution of marijuana has been very, very badly handled. And the takeover of the state Senate, this past year by Republicans, even though they did not have a majority of the seats in the state legislature, and even though we just elected, a larger Democratic majority in the state house and the most progressive state governor that Washington state has had in some time. We had the state Supreme Court, rolling back Tim Iman's requirement of a 2/3 approval for fee and tax increases, but it didn't make any difference in Olympia because suddenly the state Senate now has veto power over everything and almost nothing happened. The state budget was a very, very bad budget this year, and almost nothing else got passed, including that lack of transportation bill and lack of ability for King County to fund Metro because of a couple of state senators jumping to the Republican caucus.
Yeah, and right now we're going through a big national movement to raise the minimum wage. Well, this year the Senate Republicans down in Olympia were trying to do the opposite. They didn't want to raise the minimum wage. Oh no, they wanted to lower it. They proposed a training wage bill to cut the minimum wage to 75% of the state minimum wage for the first 680 hours a new employee would work. That, if you look at it, for somebody full-time would be 17 weeks. For somebody part-time, that's a good 6 to 8 months, their first 6 to 8 months, making only $6.89 an hour, which would be less than the federal minimum wage. That's your Senate Republicans down in Olympia.
And
they also tried to repeal a bunch of other things. They wanted to repeal the Seattle's paid sick leave law. They wanted to make big changes to the workers' compensation program. The Republicans weren't for helping people who are struggling, who are working and struggling. They were for helping employers.
Yeah, and again, seeing people who are working and struggling, the rationale behind that quote-unquote training wage is, well, they're just teenagers at their first job.
Not true.
Most people with low-wage jobs at this point are not teenagers. They are single parents. They are people with multiple jobs. They're trying to support families.
Mm-hmm. How does the training wage compare with what they get in Olympia?
Quite a bit less.
Okay.
Also on my list too, I had some stories about the SPD's 30 secret surveillance cameras that were blown wide open to the public. Also, its wireless network with 160 antennas, which was installed without any public notice, and the two aerial drones that they got approval from the FDA to purchase and start using, which they didn't tell anybody about. These stories were blown open. They were finally talked about in the public. There was public outcry, and all of these things were either decommissioned or turned off, or in the case of the drones, sent back to the manufacturer.
However,
they haven't been sent back, though. They're in a warehouse.
They're in a warehouse.
And all the federal money that was used to purchase these from the Department of Homeland Security, those types of programs have been going on since 9/11. There's been a steady militarization of not just SPD, but local law enforcement all over the country. SPD has been very much at the forefront of that movement, and that militarization, of which the surveillance stories were and the drones were just a part, that still has not been widely covered and has not really been talked about as part of the reform process.
Yeah, and speaking of SPD reform, the recent report that was released by the court-appointed monitor of the SPD reform is not very different from the first report that was issued back in April. This was not covered at all in the media. The fact that back in April he was saying that much of the SPD management was resisting reform, and then he had to say it again in November, that was not covered in the media. That in fact, even though it seems that reform is moving forward, you know, there are elements in the police department that have dug in their heels and been pulling back and are resisting.
Yeah, and it's not just the police department, because it's come from the top. Mayor McGinn's
also
obstruction of the reform process, not just this year, but for the past couple of years, really has not been called out as such by media. And it particularly was not called out when he ran for re-election and was taking credit for reform and talked about what a great agent of change he was, when in fact what actually has been playing out over the past couple of years is exactly the opposite. He was not called for those blatant lies.
Yeah. Also on my list is the failed public-private partnership of the Pacific Place Garage. Folks might remember back when Nordstrom moved and rebuilt downtown that as part of their deal, the city council voted to give them a garage, essentially, to put a whole bunch of public money into building a parking garage for that redevelopment project.
So lots of peas in there.
And to, lower the parking rates in the garage, in essence, to subsidize the parking rates in the garage in order to get people downtown to shop at Nordstrom and some of the other stores that were developing at that time, too. Well, that garage has never been much of a money maker, but in recent years in particular, it's been going downhill. The city council has put $6 million into it. They put another $2 million in the current budget that they're going to pour into it, with the hopes that they will have it fixed up and ready to sell next year. Want to take a bet on whether the public's going to end up making money on that or not? My guess is we won't.
It's been a poor bet.
It's been an example of where public-private partnerships really fail the public.
The public-private partnership at Pacific Place is a poor bet because it was a putrid package.
To begin with, yes.
Yes.
Also on my list are this summer, average rents in Seattle just reached record highs. Capitol Hill, the average rent this summer was $1,395 per month. That's always been considered one of the cheapest and best places for folks living in the city of Seattle to find an apartment, and rents there have just skyrocketed. In the downtown Belltown region, usually considered the most expensive area, the average rent is $1,707 a month, and the size of apartment units has been going down in these newer buildings. If you go in and look at the size of a unit, it's much smaller than in some of the older housing stock.
Yeah, because we really want to be like Manhattan, at least in that respect.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
The corporatization also. A couple of Seattle school items. The school district's relentless march toward testing and toward charter schools, and we'll talk about the charter schools and this week's court ruling in a few minutes. But at the same time, hasn't gotten much attention. They have been relentlessly defunding and doing their best to try and destroy the various alternative schools in the school district. And something that has gotten almost no local media coverage, the Federal Department of Education investigating Seattle Public Schools for the disproportionate discipline of black students is happening at the same time that alternative schools and schools targeting racial minorities, particularly African Americans, and also the Indian Heritage High School have been cut back. So again, more business as usual, only worse. It's under a new superintendent at Seattle Schools.
there were a couple of good things that happened this year.
Yes, that's nice.
On the city level, the city council passed its new rental housing inspection program. That was great. It didn't get nearly enough press because I think a lot of folks who could take advantage of it, folks who make less money and live in the rental housing program, have to rent a home, should know a lot more about how that works and how to report problems. That should have gotten more coverage. Also, the city council approving their socially responsible banking rules. That was a good thing. The city now must take bids from banks and credit unions and consider community involvement criteria in selecting a bank. Also, on the regional level, the Pacific Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy, one of those good regional programs where folks on a local level are addressing climate change. The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington and the premier of BC signed that agreement this year to institute carbon pricing mechanisms in all four states. California and BC already have carbon pricing mechanisms. Oregon and Washington pledged to do the same at the state level. We'll see if that actually happens.
Yeah, that again is dependent on removing the bottlenecks of Republicans who are in the state Senate at this point.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on underreported?
Oh, I'm sure there were plenty more, but those are the big ones.
All right. Well, you mentioned charter schools.
Big ruling this week by the Washington State Supreme Court, saying basically that the initiative that was passed last year by voters and funded largely by corporate charter school interests, including the Gates Foundation, Paul Allen, et cetera, is unconstitutional. And the specific part of it that's unconstitutional is the part that provides for charter schools using publicly funded construction monies and capital funds in order to build or maintain school district owned buildings without any actual public control over the use of those facilities. That is the part that's unconstitutional. They did find other provisions of it constitutional involving the actual administration of the schools, but for the time being it is a setback for the charter school movements because primarily, particularly in Seattle, they have been focused on using existing school buildings and leasing them for a dollar a year or something from the school district.
Which is essentially a public subsidy to the charter schools.
And that actually is not constitutional because, again, taxpayers do not have any control through, say, an elected school board over how public facilities are being used.
All right. Moving on to national developments with the Volcker Rule.
Yeah, this week one of the big pieces of Dodd-Frank, the financial supposedly reform plan that was passed after the recent recession, that rule was approved by the five agencies that were overseeing its drafting. The Volcker Rule could have been a lot stronger than how it turned out. There's a lot of pieces to it. It's a big, thick rule. There's a lot of pages to read if you want to read it from start to finish, and it's very technical reading as well. There are some parts they could have made stronger. For example, banks can, it's supposed to prevent banks from trading, in the market on their own behalf. They're supposed to focus mainly on their clients' behalf. A lot of banks got into trouble in the early aughts, early to mid aughts, got into trouble because they built up huge positions and are continuing to get into trouble because they build up huge positions in one particular derivative or one particular market. And when that crashes, then suddenly the bank needs rescuing or it can put the financial system at risk. So, but the Volcker Rule, the new Volcker Rule, named after Paul Volcker, who proposed it in the first place, banks can still build up positions to, quote, meet the reasonably expected near-term demands of clients, customers, or counterparties. That means that they can anticipate whether or not they're going to have clients who want a particular stock or want a particular derivative, and they can buy up a whole bunch of it.
Or they can create those clients.
Yes, or they can say, well, we anticipate we're going to start selling this product to our client, therefore we want to buy a whole bunch of it. That's a slippery slope. Also, it allows the banks to do proprietary trades in bonds issued by governments, so they can do the same thing with bonds. I think that's also a slippery slope. There's a bunch of other things in there that also allow banks to hedge. They can build up positions in trades in order to hedge other positions that they've taken. So, in other words, there's still plenty of opportunity for them to kind of get around the Volcker Rule. And I wasn't very happy with it, but uh, But it's I guess, a first step.
Yep, as we keep seeing with these financial reforms where they just find loopholes, do the same thing.
And once again, there are many, many other pieces of Dodd-Frank that still have not been enacted.
Yeah. A lot of stuff this week around the NSA. We had The Guardian coming out with a report that on Sunday, a White House review group will be issuing a report on the NSA and reforms there that a participant is describing as shameful, an apparent decision by the White House to leave most of the National Security Agency's bulk spying intact. The person involved who's spoken out, a guy named Sasha Mainrath, who's the director of the Open Technology Institute, said yesterday the review group was searching for ways to make the most modest pivot necessary to continue business as usual, which presumably includes playing video games.
Yes, it includes spies, young geeky guys sitting down at their desks, spending all day on World of Warcraft on the public dime, which I think should be held up as exhibit number one in government abuse. And you give a government agency the ability to do anything and everything it wants in secret without public oversight. What are they going to do? Hire a whole bunch of guys to sit and play video games all day? That, in my mind, is probably one of the worst things I've heard so far about the whole NSA controversy.
Yeah, and you know, basically there are 7 billion people on the planet, and they see as their mandate to monitor any and every possible means of communication, whether it's two people talking in the park or on the phone or on email or on Second Life or in World of Warcraft or whatever, in role-playing games, whatever, they want to know about it. And so we had also today a number of the tech companies whose customer confidence depends on confidentiality of information putting aside their business differences and coming together to demand the U.S. government back off. We had Google, Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, Microsoft, Apple, LinkedIn, and AOL all signing an open letter, which was also taken out print ads today, to demand that Congress and President Obama scale back the government's surveillance programs. Quote, this summer's revelations highlighted the urgent need to reform government surveillance practices worldwide. The direct
quote. I knew this was coming.
And two things about that. Number one, we're going to get the review group tomorrow that says, well, they're not going to really do any of that. That's okay. And, number two, it's going to be very interesting seeing who exactly has more power, the companies that actually run communications for the planet or the government that wants to run communications for the planet. It's kind of hard to know who to root against on that one.
Also, should be noted that most of those companies that signed on were complicit in the revelations that came forward.
Well, yes. Some of them were, and others didn't really realize the degree to which the NSA was tapping into their systems. For example, Google didn't realize how much the government could actually go and look at the data that it was moving between its data centers.
Yeah.
So I think that was a big surprise to them, and now they're getting complaints from their customers, I'm sure, saying we don't want to go with you, Google, because you weren't encrypting your data when you were moving it between your data centers, and so we're going with somebody else. And these companies are feeling the pinch, I think.
And I
mentioned this when all these revelations were coming out, that these companies were going to start seeing that getting complaints from their customers and seeing an impact to their bottom line, and that was going to affect the business model for a lot of these tech companies.
And we wouldn't be talking about any of this, and none of this would be happening were it not for that horrible, horrible man, Edward Snowden.
Events.
Yeah, today, we are on the first anniversary of the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut last year. And, of course, you know, with all the massive amount of gun control reform that's happened in the year since, today is a day for celebrate. Oh, wait. There is a commemoration going on today, however. Excuse me while I weep for a second. Today from 5:30 to 6:30, there'll be a commemoration of the first anniversary of Newtown. That'll be at First Methodist Church in Seattle. That's at 180 Denny Way in the Denny Triangle Belltown area, downtown Seattle.
Also coming this week, Monday, December 16th, you should go to the King County Metro Open House on bus service cuts down in Kent. It's at the Kent City Commons from 6 to 8 p.m. on Monday.
All right.
And that's the last one, is it not?
Oh, no. There's a couple more coming in January, but that's the last one for this year. You should go and let them know what you think about Metro cutting their service when there's so much demand for it.
Talking with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.